Good morning, everyone. We're going to call the first meeting of the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee to order. I want to welcome everyone to the committee. Looking forward to a great session and working together with all of you. I thought we would start and just kind of go around the table, introduce ourselves, and just maybe let folks know how long you've been on the committee and kind of name, serial number sort of thing. And Jim, why don't we start with you down at that end?
Jim Gelman, BFL Caucus Research. I've been around state government for 30 years. I started when I was 15. So.
Representative Mike Nelson. I was the previous chair of this committee the last 2 years. So,
Representative Jim Nash, and I've been on this committee for about 4 minutes now.
Welcome.
Representative Peggy Scott, and same. I'm a newbie to this committee.
Representative Yvonne Seltzer, and I have not served on this committee before, and I'm looking forward to it.
Cheryl Joachim, and new to the House, so I have not served on this committee before.
Cindy Pugh, and I'm entering my second term, and I did serve on government operations, and am honored to be the vice chair of this committee. Looking forward.
Amanda Tinsley, committee administrator.
And I'm Tim Sanders. I have the privilege of chairing this committee. And I'm starting on my seventh year on this committee.
Nolan West, I'm the committee legislative assistant.
I'm Mark Shepard from House Research, and I work on state government issues in this committee.
I'm Deb Dyson from House Research, and I cover local government law.
And Matt Garen from House Research, I cover campaign finance and election policy.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for stepping up to chair this committee. I'm Kelly Fenton from Woodbury, House District 53B, and happy to be here.
Tiama Tice, this is my second term and my second round on government operations.
I'm Lori Halverson from Egan, and I served on the election committee last term, but I'm new to government operations.
Carolyn Lane, fifth term, and same thing. This is new to government operations, but been on the elections committee.
Representative Tom O'Driscoll, and surprised to learn that I'm one of the longest serving members on this with the chair and the lead, Representative Nelson, on the committee. It's I've been on, this will be my fifth year on this committee, and I've been on this ever since I've been in the legislature.
Good morning. I'm Linda Runbeck, District 38A, and actually served on government operations back in the Senate a long time ago. So happy to be here.
I'm Abby Loesch, and I am with House GOP Research.
If we could have our committee pages introduce themselves to everyone.
I'm Sam Moyer, and I'm a first-year committee page, and I'm happy to be here.
Great, Sam. Well, thank you all, and to everyone out there, you can tell we have a lot of new members on the committee, so we're going to invite some groups up today just to give a brief introduction, kind of give us a very quick introduction to who they are and, you know, the issues that they work on and or agencies that they work with, and make sure that you can put a name with a face. But first, I want to go over just a couple of committee rules. These will be posted online. They were sent out in email form to the members last evening. I'm not sure if they're in your packets or not, but they are in the handout tray, which we can get to you as well. We will do our best to start at 10:15. We need at least 8 members here, so make sure you're one of the 8 at 10:15 so we can start on time. Obviously, we're sharing the building. There's a lot more going on, and so we really need to be punctual for everybody's schedules. Meeting attendance is required of members. If you cannot make the committee, please talk to Nolan West, the CLA, the committee. We will not be having a 24-hour rule. We will have an 8 a.m. rule, which is all substantive amendments need to be submitted to Amanda Tinsley, our CA, by 8 a.m. the morning of the committee. And that way we can make sure that amendments are hopefully in proper form and we can get those amendments to all of the members. We're doing that because committee is a place where the work should be done. We should be getting our work done here. We should be extending you know, common courtesy and making sure that we are focusing on good policy and what's good for the state of Minnesota. And so hopefully we can be respectful and, you know, do our work here in committee. And also one of my hopes this session with all that's going on, a divided legislature, is that hopefully when we bring a bill to committee, we've done a lot of the groundwork already. We've met with opposition. We've met with interested folks. And you're at a point where everyone either agrees or you're working towards agreement, so that way we can be very punctual. We will have a very high workload in this committee. So anything you can do beforehand, before you get to committee, to make sure that your bill is in the shape that it needs to be in to move on to the next step in the process will be beneficial for your piece of legislation. Any testifiers that you have, make sure that you coordinate those with the CA. It is the bill author's responsibility to make sure that there are testifiers, if you so wish, and that you let us know who those folks are. But like I said, all of the other rules are posted online and are available on the handout card. So with that, we're going to get into introductions. Again, for those that are coming up today, we really are looking for just a five minute or so introduction of who you are, so we can put a name with a face and let us know the issues you're working on or who you're working with. And that way, when we have questions or working on issues, we know who to contact. So it looks like, to accommodate schedule, we're going to start with the Minnesota Sports Facility Authority. If you could work your way down here for that. And then after them, so you're ready, we'll go to the Department of Administration. Hi. Good morning. Welcome. Introduce yourself to the committee, and
you
can proceed.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being here. My name is Michelle Kilm-Hogan, and I'm chair of the Minnesota Stadium Facilities Authority. The Sports Authority was actually formed in 2012 as part of the legislation to build the new stadium. It essentially replaced the old Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission. And the main difference was the old commission had seven members, six of which were appointed by the city of Minneapolis. Only the chair was appointed by the governor. The new stadium authority has three members appointed by the governor, the chair, which is what I serve as, which actually now is a full-time job to sort of oversee the operation, the development of the stadium. And the governor appoints the chair and two other members. And we also have John Griffith, who was the former vice president of property development for Target Corporation, along with Dwayne Denson, a former Republican legislator. He currently is also on the board of Minsky. So the three of us are the governor's appointees. The mayor of Minneapolis appoints two members. One is Bill McCarthy, who's the president of the Minneapolis Regional Labor Federation. And the other one is Barbara Butts-Williams, vice president of business programs at Capella University. So essentially, we serve as the developer in building the stadium, and we will be the owner and operator of the stadium as well. The legislation, as you probably all know, set it up so that basically a combination of the state of Minnesota and the city of Minneapolis put in $498 million. So essentially $348 million coming through bonds that have been sold by the state from the state of Minnesota, along with convention center tax, that an overage that's being dedicated by the city of Minneapolis to this project for $150 million. The Minnesota Vikings were originally putting in $477 million, so close to half, but they actually have already upped their contribution by $51 million to do some things in the building which were required. So their total investment today is $528 million for the project. And there are probably going to be, I know on Friday, we're adding a number of things in the building that the team is paying for. We've been very clear that obviously the state and the city's investment is capped. There is no more money. So as we look to this project to make improvements and any changes that are being made, we actually have been working with the Minnesota Vikings to have them step up and pay for those, anything that's over that amount. So they're currently sitting at $528 million, and it will increase beyond that, and we will certainly provide updates. We do that publicly at all our board meetings as additional things are added to the building. So the way the legislation was set up, we essentially were to hire a construction firm to come in as the CM at risk, the construction manager at risk. And we've hired Mortenson and Thor as the good local Minnesota company as the constructor of the project, and HKS is the architect of the project. In December of 2013, we broke ground on construction, and the Metrodome was obviously demolished, and the new stadium is obviously under construction. And I've got some photos that we can walk through if we have time, or that you can take a look, that gives you sort of a timeline of the progression so you can see where we're at. The economic impact of the stadium has already been significant. As a direct result of the stadium investment that was made, there is $400 million in construction that already is well underway. If you go by the project, within two blocks of the project, Wells Fargo is doing a new campus development for essentially, along with Ryan Development, for $400 million. And that, as I say, those two office towers are well underway in construction. You've got a broader downtown east development happening with the Hennepin County Medical Center is building a new parking ramp and clinic over there, $191 million. Also, according to them, a direct result of having this stadium development and all the housing that's actually being done down there as part of the Ryan Wells Fargo development. In addition, there's George Sherman has announced a development that he's doing with a combination of office, a hotel, and residential towers that are happening within a block of the stadium, and that's roughly another $100 million in development. So already $800 million in just the blocks directly adjacent and surrounding the stadium in private development is occurring. In addition, as you probably have read, we have been selected as the host for the Super Bowl for 2018. Various studies come up with all sorts of potential economic impact. Suffice it to say, it will be significant. I know the local host committee that has been set up is looking at trying to do a better prediction of what that economic impact will be for our state, and I'm sure there'll be more of that to come. We have also been selected to host the men's Final Four by the NCAA in 2019. That's a really exciting prospect, because once you get in the mix, you know, there are preliminary rounds, there are final rounds, and they kind of have a cycle. If your facility, if your stadium is able to accommodate these big events, which our new stadium will be, and hopefully that becomes an ongoing event that we'll be able to attract. In addition, we were just recently invited by the College Football Championships group, the game that was actually just held Monday night in Dallas. They're opening up a bid period that they have invited us to become part of that bid process. So that will probably be the next thing that we look at potentially attracting. We've got over 700 construction workers on site every day right now. It will build up to about 7,500 over the course of the project. And we've got over 200 Minnesota companies that have subcontracts and are part of that construction process. So essentially, almost 80% of the work that is gone out to companies has gone to Minnesota firms of the construction that's being done. And that, of course, will continue. We do have, we provided for the committee sort of a milestone activity. I won't walk through that in specific detail, But if you do have in front of you, it's always just kind of as a way to end my presentation, these photographs, if you just start with the first one, which is the old Metrodome, I always remind people, in February of 2014, so another month yet, it will be last year, the Metrodome was still standing and had been used for a final playoff game that was done in December. The Vikings played their last game in the Metrodome. And then you can just quickly see the demolition that took place. And where you see in May of 2014, that photograph, that is the beginning of the construction. And as we walk through that, as you see the progress, the one I would point you to is the view of the site looking north. It's about the, we should have had these numbered, I'll have to do that next time. It's about the fifth photograph in. Now as you look at that, that's essentially the site looking north. As you stand on 6th Street looking toward the river, you can see what's happening there. We've got about 6 cranes on site that are doing all the work. We're over 30% constructed. As you flip through, 3 more down, you can see the interior view of the site. And it actually is looking at, we're assembling, if you've been by the project, we have this very large ridge truss that is being constructed that will hold up the roof. We've already got 6 pieces in place. There'll be 2 more that eventually connect next summer. And as you can see by the photograph there, we assemble all that on site. And this gives you a sense of all the cranes that are on site. As I say, there are 6. There are probably, as I look at these pictures, many more right now. A little later, you can already see the corridors that are actually being built. When you come to that stadium, you actually now can step, literally there are rooms inside the stadium that are already done as you flip through these pictures. In addition, as part of the roof structure, what is being called the Queen's Post Truss is already being set, which will hold up the sides of that roof. So the roof, as you know from the photographs, comes up to a peak. There'll be that large steel beam that holds it up in the middle, and then there'll be pieces of steel that come across that hold up the roof. And as I think you know, 60% of it will be a material called ETFE, which will be basically a transparent roof where you'll be able to see sky and light and hopefully feel like you're sitting outside, and yet obviously be climate controlled for Minnesota. So as you flip through these, they just give you a sense of where we are in the construction process. So, you know, it's a big project. It's certainly not without its issues periodically, and I'm always glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Kelmhagen, for that brief presentation. I don't think we have any questions at this time, but members and staff will certainly thank you for the opportunity to reach out to you. Looks like Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering, in your bids for the Super Bowl and the Final Four, what kind of incentives were involved in the package to win that bid?
Well, the local organizing committees, you know, put together a package. There obviously are things that were required. In terms of for the Final Four, it's a little bit of a different process. There's no tax exemptions required, for example. Whereas for Super Bowl, they do require tax exemptions for the tickets that will be done, as well as the taxes on the ancillary events, so things like the Fan Fest and those kind of things, they request tax exemptions for that. So the package was put together. I know that there were conversations with the chairs of the local organizing committee, with the leadership, both Democratic and Republican, in the House and the Senate, as well as the governor, talking about primarily focused on some of those tax exemptions. I do know that the local organizing committee for the Super Bowl has now hired an executive director, and I know they are working to sit down with the NFL and really further understand what really, now that they have the bid, what really is going to be required and what's possible. And I know they'll be coming to talk at the legislature about what it is, what bill they'll have to come with for those things. So
thank you.
There's more to come. Okay.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Next up, we have the Department of Administration, and then after them on deck is the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Welcome to the committee. If you both could introduce yourself for the record and proceed, we'd appreciate it.
Great. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Matt Shear, Legislative Director for the Department of Administration, and joining me today is Assistant Commissioner Lenora Madigan. And I'm here today to provide you with a brief overview of the principal activities of the Department of Administration in our jurisdiction and state government. The department was created by Governor Harold Stassen in 1939 and was founded on the idea that we can use economies of scale, specialized expertise, and other strategies to get the best value for our government services. Our mission is to provide the best value in government service. And to accomplish this mission, we focus primarily on customer satisfaction by providing valuable results, continuous improvement by reducing costs and optimizing performance, and through employee engagement by enabling and encouraging our staff to help achieve our mission. Admin services are delivered by 15 different business units that service agency customers, and it's organized into four different areas. The first area, which is community services, provides a range of services to the government and the public, including the Council on Developmental Disabilities, which provides information, education, and training that will lead to increased independence, productivity, self-determination, integration, and inclusion for people with developmental disabilities and their families. The Information Policy Analysis Division provides technical assistance for policymakers regarding government data and data practices, and services nearly 3,000 customers annually. The Office of Grants Management works to streamline and improve our state grant-making process and administers the arts and cultural heritage portion of the Legacy Amendment funds. The STAR program is a federally funded program to help Minnesotans with disabilities access assistive living technology and help improve their lives. And the state archaeologist who serves services over 300 archaeological sites each year. And finally, the State Demographic Center, which includes the state demographer, which provides demographic information upon request to state agencies and the public. Our second kind of main area is the financial management and administration area, which services the agency and provides support to small agencies throughout state government. It is comprised of three units and provides a range of services, including financial management and human resources services for the Department of Administration itself, the Small Agency Resource Team, also known as SMART, which provides administrative services to small organizations in government that need financial management and human resources services so that they can focus their resources on their core mission. SMART services, at the moment, 15 small agencies and councils, and utilizes economies of scale to bring down the cost of state government. And also, the final thing that Financial Management Administration does is it has a risk management unit, which insures over $14 billion in state property, administers the state's workers' compensation program, and provides insurance management consulting services to state agencies. Our third area is the materials management area, and that serves as the principal procurement specialists for the state of Minnesota. And they handle $2.1 billion of goods and services purchases. And through aggressive contract negotiation and utilizing economies of scale, this area of admin services achieves savings for state agencies in a number of ways, but in the last biennium, we were able to achieve $14 million in cost avoidance for government entities through contract negotiation. And they also promote equity in public contracting for veteran, minority, and women-owned small businesses. Currently, there are over 900 small businesses that benefit from contracting preference on the first $500,000 of state contracts. On the last area that admin oversees is probably the most visible to members is the facilities management area. And they provide services to the Capitol complex and state government, including maintenance, custodial, mail, facilities support, technical and parking services for the Capitol complex. We also provide construction oversight, including the Capitol restoration and the Minneapolis Veteran Home projects. We consult with other agencies to ensure that leased space fits their needs throughout the state of Minnesota. And we manage the state fleet, and we've returned in the last biennium $10.8 million to state agencies by selling over 5,000 lots of state property through our surplus property liquidation program. In addition to these four areas, the Commissioner's Office actually also oversees Minnesota's Office of Continuous Improvement. And to date, admin and the Office of Continuous Improvement has trained over 4,300 public employees on continuous improvement principles that aim to refine process, reduce waste, and ensure the highest levels of efficiency and performance within state government. Some of these efforts have provided real results, including improving the permitting process at the Department of Natural Resources, reducing the time it takes to issue and renew licenses at the Department of Labor and Industry, reducing staff time dedicated to handling appeals at the Department of Human Services. This year, the office currently offers five courses, including Continuous Improvement 101 and Kaizen Facilitation. Beyond that, one thing I did want to bring your attention to, which is in your packets, is a map of the state of Minnesota. I just wanted to stress that we are truly a statewide enterprise, and this map indicates by the numbers number of services, trainings, and products that admin provides to each county throughout the state of Minnesota. And with that, I did want to thank you for allowing me to provide a brief agency overview, and look forward to working with you all this session. And that concludes my presentation, and we'd stand for any questions if there are any.
I don't see any initial questions. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shearer, could you just go into a little more detail on the Central Service Agency? I mean, what might be some examples of, you know, the 300 services, training, or products delivered in whatever that county is?
Sure. I think I might defer that question to Assistant Commissioner Madigan.
Hi, for the record, my name is Lenora Madigan, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Administration. Through all the types of services that Matt described, they could be arts and cultural heritage grantees, they could be public broadcasting grantees. We provide a lot of training from the Information Policy Office. The Demographic Office does presentations throughout the state, particularly with the census, helping people understand what the impacts are on the local government. We have a lot of partners in policy as a program that the Disability Council works with and administers, and that's helping people with disabilities learn more about how to be more included in their communities and be a voice for themselves. We also do a lot of work with the Federal Program of Assistive Technology, and that is getting technology devices into the hands of the public that need them to be successful in their lives. So those are just examples. If you have specific questions about counties, we certainly can go back and get that information. But broadly, those are the types of services we provide throughout Minnesota beyond just the reach in the Capitol complex.
Mr. Chair, maybe just a follow-up. When you talk about the grant administration, you know, we've seen newspaper articles and accounts in recent days of, you know, nonprofits that may not be spending tax dollars, you know, very smartly. So I'm just curious, when you are doing the oversight, I mean, is there a standardized reporting system? Or, I mean, how do you gain control over how the dollars are spent, given that there appear to be thousands of them?
Assistant Commissioner Madigan.
Each agency does it differently, and the Office of Grants Management resides in the Department of Administration. And if we'd want to talk more about that, I think that would be helpful to bring them in to have that discussion. There are a number of grant policies statewide that the Department of Administration oversees. Those we follow in terms of ensuring that the grant dollars are spent effectively and that we're monitoring each grant. So there is processes within the Department of Administration for the grants we specifically administer, as well as the enterprise, in which we really, as a government, are working to make sure those things do not happen.
Mm-hmm. And
Representative Runbeck.
And Mr. Chair, then it would be helpful, I think, to kind of explore that area a bit more and perhaps get some other testimony, learn more about it.
Agreed.
Thank you.
Thank you both for coming in today and providing us with an introduction. Thank you for that. Next up, we have the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board, and on deck is Minute. Welcome both of you to the committee. If you could, just introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is George Beck, and I'm chair of the board. With me today is Gary Goldsmith, our executive director. He's here in case you ask a complicated question. And he's also going to give a brief overview of our responsibilities. I did want to mention that we are kind of a unique board, and that's because we're a six-member board. We cannot have more than three of one political party. We can't approve or pass anything without four votes. And we're also confirmed by the Senate, and somebody had the good sense to provide that the House has to confirm us too. So I think we're probably the only board in the state that has to be approved by both bodies. With that, I'm going to ask Mr. Goldsmith to describe what we are doing and what our plans are.
Mr. Goldsmith, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. If you don't already know it, my phone number is 651-539-1190. And I'm there to answer your questions, your treasurer's questions, or any constituent questions about what the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board does. I'd like to introduce another person who's very important with the board who's here today. I'll ask him to stand up. This is Jeff Sigurdsson. He's the assistant director. And if I'm not available, you can ask him anything that you can ask me. And if we don't know the answer, we'll talk about it. And if we have to bring it to the board, we'll do that. But we are your number one resource for any questions about campaign finance or the things that fall under the board's jurisdiction. And that includes not only campaign finance, but lobbyist registration and disclosure, and also disclosure of economic interests of public officials. You'll actually have four board confirmations coming before you this year, assuming the governor makes the remaining appointments. These are due to either expiring terms or retiring members, and so you'll have a DFL legislator. That person has not yet been appointed. You'll have a former Republican legislator. That person has not yet been appointed. And then a DFL member and a Republican member, both of whom have been appointed and are subject to your confirmation. As you probably know, because you're all regulated in one way or another by the board, one of our primary focuses is campaign finance and public disclosure. So your campaign committees are registered with us, your treasurers report to us, and you're subject to sort of all sorts of rules and regulations, and that's why we get lots of phone calls about the details of those regulations. I want you all to understand that we recognize that your treasurers are typically volunteers. We value your volunteer treasurers just as much as you do, and so we want to be a resource for those people. They should never be afraid to call us. Even if they have a problem, we're there to help them work it out. We'd rather have things worked out in cooperation with staff than to have an opponent or somebody in your district file a complaint and have to have a matter come to us that way. So they should never be afraid to call us, and typically we're going to answer our own phones or return calls promptly if we're not at our desks. By statutory mandate, the board does make recommendations to the legislature each year, and this is not the bill introduction meeting, but you'll have one of those, and we'll have at least one and maybe two bills to come before you, and we'll discuss those at a future meeting. Anytime a member wants to meet with me or Mr. Beck or with both of us together, we're available. So if you want to go over a bill in private in your office or an issue, just let me know, and we'll come over and we'll be happy to do that. I wanted to make just one brief comment about the Department of Administration, in particular the SMART team, Small Agency Resource Team. The Campaign Finance Board is a part of that program. We were an early adopter. In fact, 7 years ago when I became executive director, one of the first things we did was move into the SMART program, and eventually that allowed us to change an office manager position into a program position, and so be able to provide better support to our constituents and the public. It's a valuable program for small agencies. It eliminates the need for us and other agencies like us to have a staff member who learns the ins and outs of the payroll systems and the HR systems and purchasing. So it's a very valuable program. We support it, and we will continue to be a participant in that program. And I always recommend it to my colleagues in other small agencies. I think with that, I will stand for questions or ask Mr. Beck if he has something more to add.
Members, any questions? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if you know of any laws currently within the Campaign Finance Board that would prohibit a legislator from being a lobbyist during session.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, there is no specific prohibition of that type in Chapter 10A, and the board administers Chapter 10A, which is the is the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board Act. We also administer three provisions of Chapter 211B, which is the Fair Campaign Practices Act. Under those, there is no such prohibition. Minnesota does have some conflict of interest laws. The board's primary role in those laws, though, is to obtain disclosure of financial interests that might cause a conflict. And then there is a provision that would require any official, not just a legislator, but any official to notify the head of whatever agency or board that official is serving on if there's a potential conflict. In some cases, though not the legislature, there's an obligation to recuse, but in the legislature it's handled a little bit differently. So while we have some limited jurisdiction and disclosure authority for conflicts of interest, it's not a strong one.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Members, any other questions? If not, thank you both gentlemen for taking the time. We really appreciate it. Good job. And just so everyone knows in the audience, as we were talking about campaign finance and elections, since we do have purview over all elections policy, we will try as much as possible to put all elections bills on one day, you know, maybe hopefully a Wednesday, something like that, so that those of you that are here specifically for elections issues don't need to waste your time on Tuesdays and Thursdays or whatever, however it may work out. But we will try and make that as clear and obvious to you as much as possible, just so everyone can coordinate their schedules. But as always, all bills will always be posted to the website at their appropriate time, but we will try and put all elections bills together as much as possible. With that said, if Minute could work their way up here for a brief introduction. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is John Eichten. I'm Legislative Director for Office of Minute Services. At Minute, our mission is to provide high-quality, secure, and cost-effective information technology that meets the needs of our business customers, of government, fosters innovation, and improves outcomes for the people of Minnesota. Just a little bit of background and context for those that might not be aware. 2011, the legislature passed the IT consolidation law that brought all of the state's executive branch IT functions, personnel, services under the umbrella of the Office of Enterprise Technology. Just to clarify, what is not included there would be the judicial branch, legislative branch, cities, counties. Those are outside the scope of consolidation. But in that process, we instituted service level agreements by June 30th of 2012 with roughly 70 agencies, boards, and commissions. Now, some of these boards and commissions had almost little to no IT spend, but we did enter into service level agreements per the statute, which with each of them, and we now manage all layers of executive branch information technology. So that would, I did provide a handout here just so members are aware. So that would include business and citizen-facing applications that directly serve the people of Minnesota. Think there about MinSure, the unemployment insurance system that allows citizens to go online and access their unemployment insurance benefits. We also provide state knowledge worker support, so think about communications tools such as email, phones, collaboration tools like SharePoint, as well as internal operations applications such as Swift and the state budget systems. In terms of email, I should point out we did bring all agencies on board to one enterprise email system. It's a Microsoft Office 365 package, but that is, it's an example of one initiative. It actually predated the consolidation law, but where we've been able to come together on a single platform and allows much easier collaboration across agency boundaries. We also provide back office infrastructure, so think about the data centers, servers, the operations that host the state applications, as well as the state network. You might have heard of MNET, that serves not only state agencies, but the courts, higher education, local government, police, and many school districts, not all, but many school districts. I'll touch through the by the numbers section here on the handout just to give you a sense of kind of the magnitude of what we do. We have roughly 2,113, so it's a pretty exact number, full-time employees, a roughly $880 million biennial spend. The vast majority of that comes from agency chargebacks through MNET's revolving fund. We have 22 agency-based offices, so when the 2011 consolidation law passed, we didn't move everybody into a brand new building or something. They stayed physically where they're at, serving their business customers. However, through tactical plan projects and redesign initiatives, they are sort of spun up into virtual teams that design the future of consolidated centralized services for the executive branch. We host and support over 2,000 agency applications. So again, think unemployment insurance, Swift. We manage roughly 8,000 mobile devices. We send and receive 10 to 15 million emails per month. Another 5 million, I'll note, get rejected as spam every month. We scan 90,000 plus assets, so servers, network equipment, workstations monthly for vulnerabilities. That's our enterprise cybersecurity team. I should point out there, though, that they serve outside the executive branch. They serve a lot of your cities, counties, higher ed institutions. That function is generally funded, and that allows them to assist other government entities in their cybersecurity efforts, doing things like incident response, vulnerability management, forensics when issues do occur. We manage a portfolio of roughly 500 IT projects within the state's executive branch. And I did cover the cybersecurity team, which serves outside. I also, in your packet, I did include the five-year master plan for MNET. There will be an update or report on that master plan and progress against the plan coming out in the next few days, actually. That's a legislative mandate. And then I'll just step through a few of our strategies. MNET strives to fulfill its mission through five key operational strategies. The first is to improve IT service management. We work to do that by standardizing service level management for all services, both those that are centrally delivered from an enterprise perspective, as well as services that are agency-based, that are unique to a particular agency, in order to improve outcomes, reduce costs, ensure accountability. We work to focus the state IT project portfolio by assessing and improving project and portfolio management, establishing consistent project methodologies across the executive branch to try and better ensure the overall success of project execution and completion. We implement organizational consistency by standardizing agency IT policies and management practices, developing functional alignment across agencies and between MNET's sort of central office, which would be considered what you would think of as the old Office of Enterprise Technology, and between central and these agency-based offices, to better define roles, skills, expectations, and try to foster collaboration and interoperability across programs. We're also working to analyze and address inconsistencies in employment terms and practices and try to create a path for career options for Minute employees in the future. We have a significant retirement rate, a lot of institutional knowledge that's likely to head out the door in the next few years, and we're very focused on the next generation of IT leadership. In that sense, the next bullet, we work to foster leadership and encourage high performance and innovation, set clear expectations, and provide training and mentoring to build those leadership ranks for the next generation. And we're also working to creatively attract strong IT leadership from outside of government into state government service. It's a competitive market, but we do what we can to highlight the benefits of state service and draw in those talented IT leaders. And then we work to practice financial management and accountability by standardizing financial management of IT budgets based on the total cost of ownership of IT. That's something that pre-consolidation, I don't think we had a view into as an executive branch what the full cost of information technology is, but we do have that now. And we're also working to revise IT procurement functions and processes to maximize the effectiveness of contract management and the power of enterprise contracts, and try to streamline the IT procurement processes. I'm sure you all know by the time you get your phone, it's out of date and there's a new phone coming along, and we work with our partners at the Department of Administration to try to streamline the procurement of IT so that we can best meet the needs of our business customers in a timely and effective way. So that was a lot in a short amount of time. I apologize if I went quickly, but I'm happy to answer any questions. And I should note, on the back here, we do have a breakdown of the budget. You'll see we're largely a chargeback organization. Internal Service Fund makes up 95% of our budget. Half the budget goes to payroll, and roughly half the budget comes from a handful of large agencies that have significant IT spend, DHS, DPS, DOT. And then lastly, our executive team membership is detailed here. It's 24 hours old, so it's out of date already. Just an hour ago, press release went out. We have a new state's chief information officer, also known as the Commissioner of Minute Services, and that person is Tom Baden, who has previously served as the commissioner or the chief information officer for the Minute team at DHS. So that's a little bit of the latest news, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Eichten. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And two things. First, I don't think we got the handout that he's talking about, that he's working off of. I don't think we got that passed out to us.
Anyway. The page, I apologize.
Anyway, the second thing is, I guess, you mentioned MNsure, and I see there's a bill in to make MNsure come under Minute. Is MNsure already under your control, or, I mean, I guess what's the confusion there? Because I've heard that for the last few years, that since Minute was, or MNsure was started, that it wasn't under you, and people have complained about that.
It's a little bit of a, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, it's a little bit of a complicated situation. So the consolidation statute does apply to MNsure. Their IT employees are Minute employees. However, they do have exemption from certain elements of Minute statutes around project management and risk mitigation, e-services, use of the state's infrastructure for IT. So they have the ability to be, you know, I think this was posed as something that they needed for the speed of business, to be able to operate at the speed of business. So they have the option to potentially go elsewhere, options that other state agencies don't have for their IT needs. However, we've worked in close partnership with MNsure over the last couple years. Our role stepped up even more so this last July in instituting an IT governance framework for the project and establishing some project management principles and rigor into their decision-making process and development process. And, you know, I'd like to think that that's helped improve the situation and resulted in a more positive open enrollment season this last fall.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, question for you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. You say you have 2,113 employees now under the consolidation post-consolidation. What did you have previously?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I believe it was somewhere between 250, 275 employees. That was the Office of Enterprise Technology before the name change, and it was largely focused on IT infrastructure services, so mainframe, network, operating state data centers. We didn't have under that umbrella, you know, applications or much of the citizen-facing elements of IT. It was really the infrastructure back office elements of just bread and butter IT, you might say.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Follow up, just so we can put it in for the record, the total number of employees prior and now post, I got a little caught up in your explanation there.
Mr. Acton?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, prior to IT consolidation, Minute had roughly, or OET is what it was called at the time, I believe about 250 to 275 employees. The consolidation law said everyone who does information technology, every employee who does IT and works for a state agency shall be an employee of Minute. So we went through a staged process of employee transfers where anyone who is IT at MnDOT or DHS or the Department of Public Safety moved over to officially become an employee of Minute and now reports up through our management structure.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So would it be safe to say that we have yet to see any employee savings as a result of the consolidation?
Mr. Acton?
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I wouldn't say we've seen no savings. I'd have to go back and look at the most recent report that was run about savings as a result of consolidation, but we're dealing with a pretty significant retirement factor as leaders have stepped down and moved on from their posts. A couple of our CIOs at various agencies, we've chosen not to fill those roles, and instead we've paired up agencies. So the Department of Education, Office of Higher Education, the Perpich Center for Arts Education, and the State Academies for the Deaf and Blind all report now to one Chief Information Officer. So there's been savings. I just don't have the number right off the top of my head.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. If we could maybe request that information for a future meeting.
Be happy to.
Thank you, sir.
Great. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name. I don't think I got the spelling.
Eichten? Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, yep, John Eichten, E-I-C-H-T-E-N.
Okay, thank you. About 3 weeks ago, 3.5 weeks ago in the Star Tribune Sunday paper, there was a big article on DHS and the fact that we don't have a system that adequately flags fraud in the system, particularly as it relates to folks that are come into people's homes and help assist those that are disabled, those sorts of things. For instance, people will bill for up to 48 hours when there's only, you know, one 24-hour period a day, obviously. And so even something as simplistic as that, the current system is not catching. And I'm really surprised to hear that the head of DHS IT has moved into this position now, because it troubles me that the poor track record in DHS right now of catching this fraud. It's hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer dollars that are being abused every year and not really going to the people that need it. And so I'm just wondering, you know, how would fixing that fit into your current strategy, if at all?
Mr. Acton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I don't know I can speak in particular to that issue, but what I can speak about is there are ongoing initiatives that are that are being led in particular by DHS. I know working with, if you've heard of TopCoder, NASA, Centers for Medicaid Services to develop systems and application frameworks that will be able to detect fraud in programs. Specifically, this one I think is for medical providers. I'd have to look into the I believe it's a kind of a home care. There's an article on home care that you're bringing up. I'd have to look into it to get back to you with more information specifically about what DHS does to try and detect, to analyze the data that they have and detect fraud. in their programs. Obviously, we have a, I know you're aware, Representative Scott, we have a complicated system of data practices restrictions in the state that, can make, you know, developing systems that aggregate data and analyze, especially personal data, to detect fraud, it can make those initiatives challenging. We need to work through the unique data practices laws of our state and the federal government. But I'm speaking generally here. I'd have to look into that article more closely to speak to it more specifically.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Eichten, then, what I just informed you of, the article in the newspaper, was that news to you today? You weren't aware of that article?
You know, I was not aware of the Mr. Chair, I was not aware of the article. I guess I haven't been keeping up to speed on my media, but, you know, as I've kind of discussed here, the breadth and scope of state government IT is pretty vast, and I'm sure that our minute at DHS team and our CIO there, now the state CIO, is well aware of it, and I'm happy to talk to those experts and get back to you with more info.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when you're having that conversation, if you could look back to, I don't know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago now, I think it was even our chairman here had a bill along with one of the senators to have some private contractors come in. I don't know if it was IBM or whoever, and they came in and said, we can do this, this, and this, and catch this amount of fraud, and you won't have to pay us up front. You know, you can take it off the savings. And I think they were just kind of patted on the head by IT and said, that's okay, we've got this. And here we are 5 years later, and we're finding out that still hundreds of millions of dollars are being squandered. And part of that article too talks about the recovery of that money. And if someone's, you know, squandering millions of dollars and then we're retrieving $50,000 of several millions of dollars of fraud from an entity, what can we do about that? I mean, this is a big problem, and I would encourage you to take it back to your folks, because it's very troubling to the Minnesota taxpayers.
Representative Scott, I did have that bill with Senator Benson, and maybe it'll come back this year. I don't know. We'll see.
And Mr. Chair,
Mr.
Eichten, Scott, I don't know if you're referencing the data analytics master contract that IBM and other entities, is that the one, just so I'm clear on?
I believe that's the one, is that not?
It was part of it, yeah. I mean, we had several IT solutions, but one did deal specifically with DHS and Medicaid, Medicare fraud. And we'll certainly be keeping our eye on that. Obviously, it was obviously a huge deal, and is a huge deal in this state, and dollars that we need to track efficiently for our taxpayers. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Interesting to, I'll dovetail on the DHS conversation. I seem to recall that there were some very overdue improvements to technology infrastructure that were made to some of our departments recently. DHS was one where their service provider were not able to actually service their IT infrastructure anymore because their programs were so old and they needed to be updated. And as a state, we had woefully underfunded technology infrastructure for some of our agencies. And I'm wondering if your department is doing some assessment of where we may be falling behind, particularly in this age of need for greater cybersecurity and the sensitive data that our state is involved with.
Mr. Eichten.
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, that's a great point, and we certainly are involved with that on several fronts. I believe what you're referencing is DHS systems modernization, perhaps. They're on a probably at least 30-year-old system that they use to deliver their human services programs, and there's some large amount of federal matching dollars available from the federal government to do systems modernization work in states across the country. I know that's ongoing. I know there's been a report, a sort of roadmap report put out by KPMG in partnership with DHS about what the future of integrated systems and integrated healthcare delivery is for that department. Another one I would raise would be the Department of Public Safety and the MNLARS program. The fact is that we have legacy systems that are in great need of replacement. The talent and skill, the resources that support them are aging out of the IT workforce, and there's continuous need for investment and in replacing some of those aging systems, because you know my leadership, my deputy often uses an analogy of a car. You can't take a Pinto and bolt onto it the safety features that we currently have today. That you'll spend 10 times the amount trying to ensure the security and safety of that vehicle than you will buying a new car where those safety features just come as part of the package. And so as we look at mandates and new policy around data security, we also need to be thinking about how are we investing in systems that will allow us to meet modern data security standards. So thank you. That's great.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you for that. And the Pinto analogy makes me chuckle because we had a Pinto as a family car when I was a child. So my parents still cringe, I think, about it. But I do think that is a really significant point if we are looking for efficiencies within our technology systems, and we are doing comparisons with organizations around the state and around the country that, and I've talked to employees from some of these agencies where we're kind of hamstringing them with I always imagine the pterodactyl in the running on the treadmill in the Flintstones, right? And we're asking them to meet the standards of a 21st century technology world with technology that isn't up to date. So,
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Question for Mr. Eichten regarding PII, or personally identifiable information. What are we doing from a best practices standpoint? Are we partnering with the private sector? Are we working with private sector to gather some of that information and implement it and maybe shorten the runway we've got to deal with PII at the state level?
Mr. Eichten.
And personally identifiable information.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, just a point of clarification. Are you asking, do we work with the private sector on system functionality to ensure the protection of PII? If that's the question, absolutely we do. Our cybersecurity team, I don't have a list of what vendors in particular we work with, but we have strong relationships with private sector partners around data security services, vulnerability management, scanning, patching, those sort of efforts.
Sure, thank you. If we could just get that as another update. Maybe we at a later date we get a more detailed update on many of the components that we're covering here.
Sure, and thank you, sure Mr. Eichten will help facilitate that information and grab that for us. Last question for you. As we are renovating and building buildings on this complex, the Senate office building, completely renovating the Capitol, what type of bill will Minute be bringing forward, as an agency bill? Is this where we see a robust bill where we're looking at what the state needs to do, as far as cybersecurity, making sure we have the safest, most robust IT services available for the Capitol complex? What type of direction are we going to see Minute going now? Kind of seems to me, since there's so much building renovation going on, now is kind of the time to make sure that we're having the real conversations to get this right. Seems like there might be an opportunity here. So just wondering if there's been internal discussions and maybe what will we be seeing when an agency bill comes forward.
Mr. Chair, we certainly have proposals up for consideration in the governor's budget that relate to cybersecurity. On the new office building, I should make clear the executive branch consolidation in Minute's role is related to the executive branch, not to the legislature. So in terms of what the Senate or the House might choose to do with new buildings and what kind of technology they want to install into those buildings, that's something we don't have much of any say in.
But whatever we do will go through. Minute will. Do we completely work outside of whatever our technology solutions are? We work completely outside of Minute?
We work at, Mr. Chair, we work in an advisory capacity with the legislature and the legislature's IT. When we have cybersecurity alerts and issues that come across our radar, we reach out immediately to the House and Senate IT to inform them, to give them assistance wherever we can. It's part of the role of the cybersecurity team and that the piece that is generally funded that allows us to do this kind of outreach But we don't make investment decisions for the legislature about IT.
All right. Thank you. As you can see, members have a lot of interest in this area, Absolutely. So we'll certainly be looking forward to working with you. Thank you for your time. Next up is the Public Utilities Commission. Welcome to the committee. If you could, state your name for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Beverly Jones-Heidinger, and I'm the current chair of the Public Utilities Commission. And with me today is Dan Wolf, recently appointed as our new executive secretary, replacing the long-serving Dr. Burl Haar. And we're thrilled to have Dan with us here. I'm going to first thank you for inviting us. It's not often that we get a chance to come before this committee, and we're pleased with this opportunity to provide you with a little information about the Public Utilities Commission. There are five commissioners. We serve full-time jobs. We are appointed by the governor. We are confirmed by the Senate. And in our position, there are certain criteria. We have to come from certain educational or professional backgrounds. We have staggered six-year terms, no more than three of one political party. And we do can be removed only for cause. I think that the clearest analogy for you in considering the Public Utilities Commission is that we operate very much like a court. We are a quasi-judicial agency. We make our decisions on the record. That is, we take evidence into a record. It is a very transparent process. We are precluded from any ex parte contacts. We meet in open meeting and are subject to the open meeting laws. And in that way, we reach decisions that are based on a record. We issue written decisions that are then appealable to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So the analogy is very similar to what you would see in a court system, with one exception. Because we are covered by the open meeting law, unlike the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, we can't go back after we've heard oral argument and discuss and try to reach a consensus. Instead, all of our deliberations occur in the public meeting, and we reach our decisions in that public setting, take a vote publicly, and then the orders are crafted to reflect the decisions that we've made. All communication with any one of us must be made on the record on any open docket, and we follow those provisions assiduously. We do invite public comment, and any public comment that the commission receives can be either filed on our website or submitted by mail, and it is then added to the electronic docket system. All docket information, all filings for the Public Utilities Commission are placed on an electronic docket system where all members of the public have access to read them, including all the public comments we receive. There are quite a network of statutes and rules that govern our process, and as I say, our decisions are memorialized in written orders that then are passed on to the court or can be appealed to the Court of Appeals. Our mission is set forth in statute to ensure safe, adequate, and reliable service at fair and reasonable rates, consistent with the state's environmental policies and other policies and practices set forth in state statute. Straightforward mission, boy is the devil in the details. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of the open dockets we have. Our scope of jurisdiction is the investor-owned utilities in the electricity and natural gas area. So we have very limited jurisdiction over municipal and cooperative-owned gas and electricity. But the investor-owned utilities, as you might imagine, do cover the largest part of the state from a point of view of both revenue and clients served or customers served. The regulated investor-owned utilities have annual Minnesota revenues of about $7.5 billion. And so that's the resources that we are regulating. And you will see from the, we also, I should mention, do have some limited authority over telephones. Since 1996, telephone service has been largely deregulated, but we have some remaining jurisdiction over landline telephones and specifically over customer service quality. Just to give you a sampling of the kind of dockets that we currently have open, we are implementing the new solar standards, the protocol for development of community solar gardens, approving the methodology to calculate the rates that will be paid for solar generation, and there are many other details involved in the solar requirements as we go from a very, very, very tiny penetration of solar in the state to a tremendous amount of consumer interest in developing more solar. And let me distinguish, too. Of course, I think we tend to think of rooftop solar, but that's vastly the smaller amount of solar that's being developed in the state. Larger community solar gardens and then utility-scale solar will have far greater impact, frankly, on the electric generation system. We also address investments to handle agency infrastructure and improve pipeline safety. The legislature approved a process to assure prompt reimbursement to natural gas companies so that we can address what's been identified as a significantly aging natural gas infrastructure, and with a serious concern about the safety of that system, desire to be sure the companies can move forward and replace pipelines to assure public safety. I know not one of you wants to have a major pipeline explosion in any district that you represent. We are not responsible for the inspection and safety standards of the pipelines. I want to make that clear. That's the Office of Pipeline Safety. But our job is to review the prudency of the investments to assure that the pipeline companies are investing prudently and that they are appropriately reimbursed for those investments. We investigate rural telephone service quality complaints. Right now, we have an open investigation on rural call completion. There are parts of the state where people who are having a great deal of trouble getting their calls through. I could explain why that may be, but we have an investigation ongoing to attempt to identify where is the fly in the ointment, who is paying whom, and who's dropping those services. It can mean a great deal to businesses in the rural parts of the state, as well as an inconvenience, obviously, for rural residential customers. We also will be initiating a rulemaking process to re-examine the question of service quality for telephone service throughout the state. Electric transmission lines, need for them, and location. We handle this. We're at the end of the completion of what some of you may be familiar with, the CapEx 2020 process. Over $1 billion in infrastructure to improve electric transmission throughout the state. As with each passing day, there is not a single residential or business customer who wants to lose their power for even a minute, much less several hours or several days. The reliability of the system is dependent on a strong investment in resilient infrastructure that can respond to outages promptly. In that regard, we do coordinate with the regional transmission operator, the Mid-Continent Independent Transmission Office is otherwise known as MISO. And if you ever want a presentation on MISO and how it affects electric transmission throughout the state, we'd be glad to work with you on setting up that or a visit to one of their three Mid-Continent offices, which is in Eagan. In addition to those dockets, we also have to approve any new electric generation above a certain. We've just completed a lengthy competitive resource acquisition process. Xcel Energy reported that it anticipated it was going to need new generation by 2019. We required them to put that out for competitive bid rather than to just do their own build project. And we have identified and selected resources for them to add to their system to serve customers reliably through 2019. Oil pipelines, probably not a surprise to any of you to hear that we have seen a big surge in applications for oil pipelines. We review them to determine the need for the pipeline, and if need is determined, then we review the siting of the particular pipeline and where it will run. The process and the timeline, both for determining need and the route, is established in statute. Both require the opportunity for public comment and environmental analysis. By statute, we review certificates of need within 12 months and the route permit proceedings within 10. There are a few exceptions that allow us to extend those slightly, but it is a very resource-intensive process that leads to, again, typically in controversial cases, a full-scale evidentiary hearing, a number of parties, cross-examination of witnesses, a written record that leads then to a written decision by the Public Utilities Commission. All of the documents for those proceedings, like all others, are electronically filed in our electronic docket system where they are easily accessible to any member of the public. Traditionally, I think the Public Utilities Commission is associated with rate cases, and we do a lot of rate cases, and am I grateful for the accountants that we have that can pour over the billions of dollars of revenues and expenses of these utilities to try to assure that they are appropriately reporting their expenses and revenues, and that they are for the benefit of the ratepayers and separating out the interests of the ratepayers and the shareholders. It's very complicated, and we want to assure that even as the demand for electricity in particular is quite flat, our energy efficiency efforts are successful, and that's a good thing. But at the same time, we have to generate sufficient revenue to assure that aging infrastructure is kept up to date, that we are meeting the demand for more renewable energy, that we are carefully examining all costs, both typical and exceptional. So typical things like how much is invested in pensions and salaries and so forth, extraordinary when there's a huge cost overrun at a nuclear plant or an explosion in a plant that requires a large investment in repairs and maintenance. And I should also mention, this wasn't on my slides, but I want to reference cybersecurity. We, too, as you heard from Minute, are extremely concerned about this. Our public utilities in Minnesota have attempts to hack them thousands of times every single day. It's very important that we be working with them to assure that they are on top of these issues, that they are investing in the protections to assure that that system operates reliably. A large-scale cyber attack on the natural gas or electricity system would have devastating consequences throughout the state. We're very well aware with that, of that. We are meeting with the public utilities to try to assure that they are investing what's necessary to protect the system. Finally, we are involved in regional coordination. The power lines and the gas lines don't stop at the borders, and that's largely a good thing, frankly. We are an interconnected system, but it increases the complexity of the work that we do and requires us to stay on top of not only what's happening in Minnesota, but all of our adjoining states and throughout the MISO region. So in conclusion, for a little agency, we are very busy. I can't tell you how proud you should be of the dedicated staff of analysts and economists and accountants and engineers that we have working. These are truly dedicated public servants. I only wish we could compensate them better, to tell you the truth. Any one of them has skills that would be far more highly compensated in the private sector, and it's a challenge for us. On the other hand, I think they are deeply committed to the work we do. They know how important it is to have a reliable and safe system, and that rates are very important to all classes of our customers, the residential, small business, commercial, and industrial customers throughout our state. I should add that we do receive an appropriation from the general fund. However, we do bill our costs back to the utilities. So when we come to you and seek an increase, it's because we do have a lot of work to do. It does not necessarily cost the general fund in the end. However, we are aware that ratepayers and taxpayers are all the same people. So we don't make any requests without those consequences being understood. But It's a very highly technical and complicated world, and as much as we love the work, it is quite taxing. Finally, if you would like to attend a meeting of the Public Utilities Commission, we do convene most Thursdays to handle open dockets, and you can watch on the web at any time if you would like to see the Public Utilities Commission in operation. And as I say, all of those meetings are webcast live, and all of the filings that we're considering are available to the public through the e-dockets system. So other than any questions you might have about open dockets, I'd be glad to handle any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Chair Heidinger.
And Mr. Chair, I should add, again, Dan Wolf, Executive Secretary for the Commission. I just wanted to add the comment, again, thank you for the invitation to be here. And part of my duties is coordinating with the legislature, answering any questions that you might have. So I'm your point of contact for any information that you need, you or your staff, any questions that you might have.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Wolf. Brief question. Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a lot of questions, so I'll try this short one here.
Thank you.
And a utility called Minn Kota, I believe it is, up in the northwestern part of the state. Familiar with that one? I think it's an electric utility.
Yes.
And
it's not one we regulate.
You don't regulate it. Okay. Because I know they made a incorrect calculation on, I believe it was solar power, got heavy into it, and now I think that their rates are really unaffordable at this point. So you didn't oversee them, I hear.
No, we don't.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you both very much. Thank you for the information and for presenting to us.
Thank you for having us.
Last one for this meeting today is Minsure. If their representatives could come forward at this time. Welcome to the committee. If you could, just introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Scott Leitz. I'm the CEO at Minsure. With me today is Larry Johnson, who is our government relations person at Minsure. Larry is in day three of his job, so very new to the organization. I also want to thank members for the opportunity to give the committee a brief overview of Minsure. Minsure was established by the 2013 legislature as the state's health insurance exchange, or state-based marketplace. States were given the option under the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as some refer to it, to either establish a state-based health insurance exchange or to default into the federal health insurance exchange. There was a decision made by the legislature in 2013 to establish a state-based marketplace, and Minsure sort of fulfills that responsibility. It went live as an organization in terms of the website on October 1st of 2013 for the first open enrollment period. And that open enrollment period lasted from October 1st of 2013 until March 31st of 2014. We're currently in the process of our second open enrollment period, which will last until February 15th of 2015. The way it works generally is that unless you're eligible for a public health insurance program like Minnesota Care or the Medical Assistance Program, the open enrollment period is the time in which you can purchase health insurance coverage, and you can do that either through Minsure or directly with a carrier if that's your preference. There's no requirement that anyone go through Minsure, that's optional, but Minsure is the one place that they can get financial assistance if they're eligible for a tax credit, for example, to purchase coverage. I joined Minsure in December of 2013, which was partway through the first open enrollment period. Minsure is chartered as a state agency, but it's overseen by a 7-member board of directors who are appointed by the governor. The general purpose of Minsure, sort of in the large screen, was to fulfill the requirement of having a single point of entry for individuals. The Affordable Care Act required that people have health insurance coverage, and so there was the law sets out a way for people to be able to find out if they're eligible for state-based health insurance programs like Medical Assistance Program or Minnesota Care, or whether they're eligible maybe to purchase private health insurance coverage but with assistance through tax credits. And what people are able to do is to go online through MNsure, receive a determination of what they might be eligible for, and then if they choose to do so, can go through and enroll in that coverage either directly with the Medicaid program, the Minnesota Care program, or with into commercial coverage with a tax credit. And they can also purchase outside of the tax credit if they aren't eligible for financial assistance directly with the carrier or through MNsure, just without financial help. That's an option that they have. MNsure is a marketplace. It's voluntary on the part of health insurance companies whether they participate and want to have their products made available. And we do anticipate, and we have seen some additions and some subtractions in the first year where one carrier chose not to offer that offered last year, and an additional carrier that didn't offer last year did come on. And so we're seeing what happens in marketplaces, which is some churn around companies that are operating. I also want to be clear that we don't set the rates. Those are rate setting is still a Department of Commerce responsibility. What I should say is the Department of Commerce has responsibility and maintains responsibility for approving rates that are offered. They've long had that responsibility. That didn't change with the establishment of a MNsure. Once those rates are approved, companies can offer them on the marketplace under that approval process. We have enrolled, we're in the middle of our second open enrollment period right now. So far, we've enrolled approximately 90,000 Minnesotans during this period. Last year, it was close to 400,000 who were enrolled. Many of those people will be renewed through public health insurance programs a little bit later this year. And now we're going through the renewal process for individuals who purchase commercial health insurance coverage. We're seeing some new individuals come into coverage, and we're also seeing some people who had previously purchased through MNsure coming back through and renewing their policies. We have focused very heavily this year on improving the consumer experience. Last fall's rollout, October through probably sometime in December into January, was rough. It was rocky. We've spent a lot of time over the course of the last spring, summer, and into the fall greatly improving the consumer experience as people come in to MNsure. Still some work to be done there, but a far, far better place to be than where we were last year. And so our focus has been very squarely in those areas. We're also working very hard with the health plan partners that we have to ensure that as people enroll and go into coverage, that the information that they have about their enrollment is transferred well and easily to the health plan so that they can get ID cards out to those individuals so they can access care. And that's been also a very heavy focus of ours this fall. The final thing I'll say, Mr. Chair and members, is that we also have been working very hard to establish and continue to grow relationships with people who help people get into health insurance coverage. Navigator organizations, brokers and agents who work very closely with individuals to get them into coverage to ensure that they're able to access care as they need to. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll stop.
Thank you, Mr. Lights. Mr. Johnson, anything to add?
Unfortunately, or fortunately, Scott did cover most of my talking points as well, but like he said, I'm on day three of my job. I'm about 18 hours officially into it, the 8 to 5 o'clock. So I'm still in the learning process. I know a bunch of you from previous work, but I want to encourage all of you to reach out to me if you have questions, concerns. If you have constituent questions, we've had several of those come in my first 2 days. We have a great staff that is able to turn those concerns or those snags or issues around quickly. So don't hesitate to call me. Amanda has all of my contact information, but I'll be around, and don't hesitate to grab me, and I'd be happy to help any way I can.
And Mr. Chair, let me just add to piggyback on what Mr. Johnson was saying, that we obviously stand at your disposal to get you whatever information you need and help you with your deliberations.
Thank you, Mr. Lights. I don't see any brief introductory questions from members, so I will say thank you, and we will certainly all be in touch. Thank you very much for coming down today. Members, that concludes the agenda for today. Tomorrow, we will have a former member of this committee and in the House, Secretary of State Steve Simon, into the committee to talk to us and give us an overview of his office and what he's looking forward to over this next session. With that, members, we are adjourned.